But it says what Tony was saying, that Houston trip, the first day was a non-official day. You're just running to get to the Grand Canyon.
It's really the young day.
So it should be able to happen.
Depending on that's your scenario. If you have to run all day, what about the guy that doesn't have to run all day? How's it going to affect him? How's it going to help him? The guy that only runs an hour and it stays offshore.
But you still limited the one-day limit. So on each day. So if he stays, if he only runs an hour, fishes the one-day limit, stays overnight somewhere, fishes the second day and gets the second day, he's still getting 2 days limit for 2 days fishing. Regardless of how far he runs, our situation with CPFBs is we have to sometimes often run long distances to get the right advice. And we're being told you either have to leave at 12:01 a.m. on Saturday morning or before noon on Friday. Well, yeah, but sometimes if you're settled in the little Cortez in U.S. zone, then we're not in the next water. We're not carrying next to my studies or anything. We're fishing straight and that way. This way, all the rest of
Have you been on the circle day?
But at least 12 hours on the last day. At least 12 hours on the last day.
That's 2 full days.
But 12 hours on the last day, you're allowed another limit.
That's the problem if we start hitting it to a full day. We define full day as 12 hours.
But it's 12 hours in the regulations.
So those are the kinds of things that we have to think about.
Yeah.
And so,
the way it's written now, it's 12 hours the first day, 12 hours the last day, so that you can have, if you left on Monday at noon, you can have a limit Monday, and came back Saturday or Tuesday at noon, you can have two limits. And what they do is they run.
Oh, that's pushing
about limits the first day. So second and third day is where they're worried about. They'll spend all day out at the second day, and then leave 12 hours the third day.
That's why we need to change that.
Good morning, everyone. How's this? Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Flores. I'm president of the Fish and Game Commission. I'd like to welcome you all this morning to a special hearing on the Marine Life Protection Act, specifically on lessons learned and socioeconomic impacts, a discussion of. I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce my fellow members. Sitting next to me is Commissioner Cindy Gustafson from Tahoe City.
Good morning.
Also with me is Commissioner Bob Hatoy from Santa Monica, California.
Good morning.
Also up here on the dais with me is our Executive Director, Mr. John Carlson. Our Assistant Executive Director, Mr. John Fisher. And our award-winning staff of Adriana Shea and Sherry Cole. Welcome to you. Also in the audience with us is Chief Deputy Director John McCammon, welcome, and Deputy Director Sankey Mastrup. I'd also like to thank our game wardens here, who are here to protect us. Assistant Chief Tony Warrington, welcome, and Captain Rob Allen. So, you ready to get this started? Actually, before we get started, I'd like to also introduce a good friend, Mr. Phil Eisenberg, who is also chair of the Blue Ribbon Task Force. You'll be hearing from him shortly. But, Phil, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for your work. Okay, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you. We're having a little change on our agenda order this morning. We're going to start with item number 2, lessons learned discussion, and then followed by the report by Michael Hardy, and we are going to hold public comment for both items until the end, so it'll be a combined public comment at the end. And if you are interested in speaking today, please turn in your speaker card up here to Sherry Cole or John Fisher. We will appreciate that. So we're going to get rolling then with agenda item number 2, lessons learned discussion regarding Central Coast MLPA initiative process, including possible future amendments to the draft master plan. And to kick that off, we are very honored to have Phil Eisenberg with us today. He's going to share some thoughts as the chair of the Central Coast BRTF. And
thank
then
you very
we'll
much,
hear from John Curlin. Thank you, Phil.
Mr. President, members, thank you very much. First, on behalf of all the task force members, at the end of this month, we complete our charge and are dismissed. It has been a very intense, two years and three-month process, and we want to say our thanks to you as commissioners for treating this process as seriously as you have and for moving ahead as the law requires, but more importantly, as your policy sense dictates. And I think it's a testament to your staff and to yourselves that you've given this so much time and so much attention, and we appreciate it very deeply. The task force members asked me to say that they wish they could be here to say goodbye also, but they decided flying once more to Sacramento was perhaps not on the agenda, and I'm sure you understand that. I'm going to make just very general comments. About a little more than a year ago, John Curlin, our executive director, made what I thought was a terrific suggestion in private conversations, and then to the task force. He said, you know, this is kind of an interesting process you're going through, and don't you think you ought to try to draw some preliminary lessons from what you will have gone through for 2 years so that the decision makers of the future who have to implement the state law may draw what conclusions they might about the process, the terms and conditions, the successes, the mistakes, and so on. And I thought that was a terrific idea. And frankly, the first time in my entire now many years, over 40 years of involvement in public life, the only time where I've seen a governmental entity ever thinking seriously while it was doing something about what it was that it was doing and drawing some lessons from it. So hopefully today's presentation on lessons learned, Mr. Curlin's presentation of the task force recommendations would be grist for your mill and give you some ideas and suggestions that might be useful and might be helpful. In context, however, I just wanted to make a couple of points. We're approaching the seventh year anniversary of the statutory direction to develop a master plan to implement the process to review the coastline of California and to set up protected areas up and down the coast. And 7 years, of course, seems like an eternity for people who wanted the process to move faster and seems like barely time enough to breathe for those who didn't. But 7 years is a remarkable period of time, and you're fully familiar with all the war stories that occurred during that seven-year period. A couple of other things that it seems to me are important that we remember. The legislation, for whatever else it said about process, made an observation that the status quo was unacceptable. And it made another urging or direction or mandate where it said the system of reserves is really designed for ecosystem protection, contrasting that with the more traditional approach, which some have called the species-specific rules and regulations. And Lord knows you have struggled with this, some of you, for years on this commission of how to reconcile it. That legislative direction to go to an ecosystem management is something that probably has been underway for decades and will take decades more to fully complete. But it is an important paradigm shift, I guess, in how you approach it. Not what you decide to do, but how you approach the analytical process. And then the other thing that all too often gets ignored in this, and it's particularly important for the commission, the legislature did in the statute, the 1999 statute in particular, but also the marine mammal statute the year before, something that they are usually loath to do. They surrendered decision-making authority to you. That, in my experience of California state government, is not usual at all. Now, some people say they were just tired of adjudicating what each tonnage for each species should look like on a yearly catch, but the reality is they made that decision, and that is now the law of the state of California. And there are very few illustrations in my memory where the legislature in an important policy area has essentially said to a body such as yours high, make the decisions within the broad frameworks of the statutes. And that then gives a context to this and also an institutional challenge to you and to the department about how to manage for the future. So the last thing I want to mention is this. The task force added our kind of summary memo, which you have, I'm sure, somewhere in the briefing packet, pointing out 10 of the lessons learned that we thought were important. And we inched beyond our own activity in the last couple of recommendations because we made two recommendations that I think are essential for the state of California. First, there must be increased support for this commission in order to fulfill the duties that are coming your way, not just through 2011, but for many decades to come. It is not possible that a commission can do the kind of ultimate decision-making on ecosystem management without more staff. I don't know what the details are, and we did not make specific recommendations on that, but it's fair that, to say that the task force is very serious about the notion that the commission needs support, and the other recommendation that the department itself needs support. And of course, this is also historic backdrop because over the time and in recent decades, the support of the general fund of the state of California for resources activities has been flat, in some case dropping, and the department and the Fish and Game Commission has not benefited as the state budget has grown in a proportionate sense. Those challenges, your operational challenges, it seems to me are as important in many ways as the specific policy challenges you face on implementing a Central Coast recommendation or modifying the master plan. And I would urge that you be pretty straightforward with the governor's folks and with the legislative folks about the notion, hey, we're okay with doing this, doing what you told us to do, but you've got to give us the tools that make it better, make us better able to understand, implement, and evaluate that. So all of those things led to our recommendations. We thought, this may be self-serving, we thought the process worked out pretty well. Not perfectly, nothing ever does, but it worked out pretty well. And in some sense, a task force gave the department and I believe the commission a little distance between the battle and the issue, allowing you to perhaps think about the issue, think about the implications, and hopefully when it got to you a few months ago, start to frame your own policy judgments in a way that served the interest of the people of California and honor the statute. It has been a pleasure working with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. John Kerlin will now give a PowerPoint presentation on lessons learned from the BRTF staff.
Well, thank you, and I wanted to take this opportunity also to publicly thank Chair Eisenberg and the BRTF members for their tremendous working experience over the 2 years I've been involved in this process. I wanted also to start with a contextual comment. I was present at the 24 hours of meetings where the small tsunami of MLPA arrived, first here in Sacramento and then in Monterey, when you dealt with the choice of a preferred alternative and of other alternatives put it through the regulatory rulemaking process. And I found myself both appreciative of the context you're in and understanding the challenges you were facing. And so I want to second very much what Chair Eisenberg said about the importance of the recommendations out of the task force, that the capacity of the commission and the department which supports you to deal with the ongoing implementation of MLPA is absolutely critical. It turns out that in the original design of the Central Coast Project, which generated those proposals that came to you, there was not a lot of attention paid to the commission. And it was visible sort of as the ultimate decision maker, and clearly the draft master plan framework came to you for action in August of 2005. You acted on that. But I think in amongst the lessons learned, we've learned some things that will help you in your role And I'm going to start off today using the BRTF memo, which is in your packet of materials, about lessons learned, talk about what is being anticipated in the design, sort of under consideration and discussion now, of the design of the next study region. I'm going to walk through a PowerPoint presentation talking about that, and Sankey Mastrup from the department is going to add in whatever comments are appropriate from his perspective, and is available to, as is John McCammon or anyone else in the department, to answer questions from the department's perspective. But this is sort of intended to be an overview of where we are in this process. The PowerPoint that you have hard copies of has a lot of detail. I'm going to trust you can look at it and read it. I'm going to be very selective in what I talk about. It is worth just reminding ourselves that this process started out with some explicit design expectations, and one was a public-private partnership. Secondly, a key bringing in some private resources in terms of money and human resources, such as myself and the other staff who brought in consultants to work with the BRTF. But the BRTF was a key element of this, intended to provide policy advice and also to direct the efforts of the initiative. So they basically directed the efforts of the staff. They made budget allocations. They're the ones who selected the packages to recommend to the commission or department, and then so the commission recommended a preferred alternative, et cetera. Absolutely critical in my judgment. And that's what the second slide talks about, is the role of the independent task force, and also mentions two other important features, it seems to me. The task force process was characterized by extensive public involvement, not only the task force and the meetings of the regional stakeholder group, the science advisory team, but broad opportunities for public comment. That hit you also, and you had further comment at your meetings, and have heard more comments about MLPA and subsequent meetings after August. And today, of course, you have a special meeting for more consideration of MLPA. There have been lots of opportunities for public input into this process. I think that's absolutely critical and appropriate, but also worth noting. Let me just mention a couple of broad lessons learned off this slide. The initiative was tasked to bring forward alternative packages which could be considered for adoption and to recommend a preferred alternative. That was done successfully. Just getting to that point and having packages which satisfied science criteria could be implemented, enjoyed reasonable amounts of success, is a substantial achievement. And I think the task force and others involved in the initiative feel good about that, as do all the members in the regional stakeholder group, et cetera. That was a substantial achievement. Most assessments of the work have been positive. There are some interests, particularly representatives of the fishing community, who are dissatisfied with the process and the outcome. They have voiced that, and I would expect them to continue to voice that. One example is the letter they sent to Chair Eisenberg in November, which I believe you've also received a copy of. We had the formal lessons learned process, and out of that process, which I was surprised when Chair Eisenberg said had never been done before, this was intended to be a pilot project. It seemed very sensible to me to invest some resources in having some outsiders look at the process and extract some lessons. That generated some specific suggestions for refinements, and some of which I'll talk about today, and others have been generated by other participants and commenters, people commenting on the process. I think that's very robust. One of the features of this sort of process is it relies on volunteers. You commissioners are all volunteers. You're sort of at the ultimate end of this thing, and you know what a workload that is. But for members of the BRTF, the Regional Stakeholder Group, and the SAT, they spent between dozens to hundreds of hours, and sometimes approaching 1,000 hours of investment in this work. That's a huge task, a huge workload. And one of the things that I think we owe that sort of process is to design it so it works as well as possible, and then to support it so it can be effective. And so we're trying to talk about ways to make that even more effective. On this slide, I want to just mention two things. One of the things that I believe allowed progress in the initiative and I think is required in a good policy process is to remain sort of focused on what the policy objectives are. There are lots of ways to talk about improving the health of oceans, fisheries, ecosystems, etc. We're working under the particular constraints and opportunities afforded by the Marine Life Protection Act, a specific statute. So the initiative, the BRTF and its staff worked very hard whenever there was uncertainty in the issue and the guidance needed, we turned to that act, and that's what was effectively our touchstone. And I think that explains a lot of what we did. And also, I think I'm very comfortable with that judgment, and you'll see as we move forward essentially recommendations that follow in that vein. The task force, as Chair Eisenberg mentioned, made 10 recommendations. They're in your packet in a memo of some 4 or 5 pages with some more explanation. This is a shorthand version of those recommendations. The task force does recommend the creation of another task force. It does recommend retaining independent professional staff. It does recommend modifying the initiative as experience suggests. And fourth, clarifying roles in support of effective policymaking by the Fish and Game Commission. So starting to think about this process of what's the ultimate decision needs to be made by you and then figuring out how best to support that is a critical consideration in how we think about refining the package. Item number 6 suggested where possible clarify relationship between MLPA and fisheries and socioeconomic considerations. Report by Michael Hardy talks about the second of those later. And then the other things to implement this, a public-private partnership, private funding, and Chair Eisenberg has already talked about items 9 or 10, effectively building the system capacity to deal with this over a long time. It's very important. Preparations for the next study region are underway. Today you're hearing some testimony about lessons learned in socioeconomics. Secretary Chrisman has asked a working group to begin drafting an MOU for the next study region. And as you know, as I understand, was announced at your meeting in Santa Monica, that announcement will be made later. It's not being made in this commission or announced today, but will be made later about what the next study region will be. A commission staff member, John Carlson, has been involved in those working sessions of the draft MOU. And we're proposing to have a representative of the commission staff participating regularly in what is effectively the management commission for the study region, which is what we call the steering committee. It's the first example of some very concrete steps to increase involvement by the staff. The proposed revisions provide more opportunities for public involvement and for the commission to see packages as they evolve. And I'll talk briefly in a moment about how that happens. I want to turn now to some more specific examples of the types of changes that are being proposed. One focuses on the creation and the composition of a regional stakeholder group. As you know, the packages that came to you were generated out of that stakeholder process. And that is, again, the expectation in the new MOU. But what is being suggested is that we do some extensive preparatory work, we being, in this case, department staff, initiative staff, and consultants, with stakeholders in the region broadly after a study region is selected, interested parties in that region, to try to work through some common expectations about how the stakeholder process will work and identify some candidates for the new regional stakeholder group. And the goal there is to have a stakeholder group which is sort of fits the model of these four bullets in terms of how it's different from the stakeholder group we had in the Central Coast. Some broader understanding of the initiative processes and the roles. It turned out one of the things that we learned in the lessons learned is despite what I thought was clarity and expression of roles, many members of the stakeholder group were surprised when the task force altered packages. Some members of the task force believed that their goal was a consensus package when all the formal communications that I understood said the goal was alternative packages. So one of the things we want to do is try to make certain we have as much clarity as possible in roles. I think whatever ambiguity there was in expression or in hearing generated some of the dissatisfaction that has been expressed and was heard in the lessons learned has been voiced publicly also. So we want to address that to the best possible. I personally think we'll never achieve perfection in that, but we will certainly improve. We'd like to have a group of stakeholders with members that are capable of broad representation as opposed, if you will, to representation of a single narrow interest. And you could imagine someone who is deeply committed to protecting tide pools and no species collecting in a particular tide pool, that's their goal. And the process is only successful if that's achieved. Or equally, someone who is committed to some dive site or some particular fishery component. Those are examples of narrow interests. We'd like to find representatives who are capable of broader representation. We're hoping to be able to constitute a regional stakeholder group which is smaller than it was last time. Last time, we had something over almost 30, I think, formal designees to the stakeholder group, and with alternates, we're often dealing with a group of almost 60. We'd like to also to have a stakeholder group that has what we're calling a larger middle of individuals who, as they enter the process, are not committed to a particular outcome, but are open, basically, to the process. We are anticipating having a regional draft of regional profile decision tools, and SAT and department guidelines ready, essentially, as the stakeholder group gets going, so that we avoid some of the sort of slowness in start and inadequacy in information and techniques that were, I think, inevitable in the first pilot, but now we should expect a higher level of performance. Similarly, now turning to what we're anticipating the stakeholder doing in the group doing and how packages get developed, we're talking about a process that'll extend over a little longer time period as it goes through the stakeholder process and to the task force, but more importantly, identifies alternative packages somewhat earlier and then provides at least a tentative workflow, 5 opportunities for refinements of those packages. And I think that's very important because it'll provide people something really concrete to say, this affects me this way, I think you've missed that here. And it will, I think, allow for better refinement of the packages. And so that's the first goal, ample opportunity for interested and knowledgeable individuals to participate. Equally, it'll increase opportunities for the department to participate. One of the positive outcomes of this experience has been that governor and legislature have increased the staff available to the department. And so the department, which was deeply involved in the Central Coast, with a few individuals, and John Ugris as an example is here, was a huge, I'll call war horse in this effort, carrying a very large load. I would expect John to be present, but have additional colleagues beyond Paul Riley, who was deeply involved in the Central Coast, and a few other individuals, particularly on the GIS side. That experience will be expanded. They'll be participating in the regional stakeholder group, and also as staff supporting that, and as proposals come forward, have ample opportunities to say, the department's interest isn't being met here, we're worried about this enforcement issue, we're worried about this management issue, and get that into the mix. And equally, this affords an opportunity for greater visibility to the commission. So as packages are being developed, and it makes sense to get it on your, before you, and personally as a full commission, that's possible, but also your staff intermediary to say, this is what the packages are, this is how they're coming together, etc. Just to continue on how packages are developed, we are anticipating again having a window for submission of external packages. You may remember that there were 2 such packages proposed in the Central Coast, one of which the science advisory team and the staff and the task force eventually decided was did not address the MLPA sufficiently to warrant further analysis and consideration, was dropped from consideration. Another one was carried all the way through the analytic processes, but eventually not recommended for consideration to the commission. That was a package AC, but some of the ideas out of that package influenced the packages which did come to you, and we think it's a valuable thing to do. We are anticipating, of course, having input at the RSG meetings, additional workshops beyond the RSG meetings to solicit input on packages, the public comment at the BRTF we had before. We're hoping, again, to do webcasting and planning to do that, email for public comments. And in our draft flow of work, we were anticipating two presentations of the packages as they evolved to the commission. Now, we also want to refine and clarify roles. These are, again, ideas under consideration, how packages are recommended. The task force will continue to guide the work of the stakeholder group. The department's deeply involved in the ways we've talked about and package development through the regional stakeholder group, the steering committee, and whatever formal comments they choose to address to the task force for their consideration. We're anticipating a somewhat changed process as the task force identifies packages to forward to you and also recommend a preferred alternative. Changed in two regards. One, process-wise, a process that is used sometimes in legislative bodies and city councils, a first and second reading process, in which there is, in essence, a here's our decision, and people have a lot of opportunity to talk about that. But it's not only a general public discussion of that, but it will go back to the regional stakeholder group and also the science advisory team for refinement, presumably or possibly visible to the commission if you have any large concerns about it. That would come back to the task force for their final decision at second reading. That is different than in the Central Coast, where by the time the task force made its decision, it did it all in one meeting, and there was no regional stakeholder group still in existence. And there was, because of it all was done in one meeting, there was an opportunity for the science advisory team to comment on the proposal. Nor were there opportunities for the department to comment on some of the changes that were made in the last meeting. There is eventually only one final decision, and that's yours, but we'd like to get certain that we get the task force to queue it up as well as possible. The other change here is under consideration is a recommendation that the packages, the determination of the packages to forward and the selection of the preferred alternative come out of the task force and come to the commission with comment, with first of all the deep involvement of the department in the development to that point, and also comment by the department. But this current thinking is not to have, as was happened in the Central Coast, a separate stage at which there is the development of a package by the department. And so I'd like to just summarize this comments with some of the changes to better support the commission's roles in the initiative. And I may have missed some, but these are some of them. Commission staff is currently involved in drafting the MOU. We anticipate having them involved in the steering committee, which is effectively the management committee. We want more updates on progress by the department and by initiative staff. We're talking about the possibility of having initiative staff participate in the briefings to the commission on what's happening with the initiative. The iteration of package development is going to make these packages more visible to the commission as they are developed, we believe, affords that opportunity. And we would anticipate joint commission BRTF meetings of the sort. We had two in the Central Coast project, and I think on reflection, my judgment, and I know you were there, so you should reach your own judgment, that they were not as effective in the Central Coast as they will be in the future, because now you've experienced this process, you know how it's going to come to you eventually, and I think those could be more effective, but equally they take time on both sides, and so I think they ought to be used judiciously. So that sort of summarizes what I had as laying out what the current thinking about the next study region is. I don't know if Sankey wanted to step up and add any comments, and I'd be happy to answer questions after Sankey has spoken.
Mr. Curley, first I'd like a question, but I would also like to, while Mr. Eisenberg is still here, thank you and the Blue Ribbon Task Force once again. The quality of work you gave to us and the amount of hours you put in and the diversity of your task force, from Mr. Wheeler to you to, you know, to Meg to Ms. Golding. I mean, it was like a group that I thought was incredibly qualified, high caliber, hardworking, and I just really appreciate the work you've done, and hopefully many of you will be involved again. Maybe I'm wishing something that you don't want, but thank you. Mr. Curlin, your recommendations, and I know we're not taking action on things today, but the one thing you said, I loved all the suggestions of more involvement of stakeholders who are working towards conclusions, not towards, you know, self-interest. I love the explanation of the fact that we are under a legislative mandate, and this isn't just something that we've decided to do, and that the law is quite clear on the things that we can and should do on this, and also your recommendations of helping this commission be more involved with staff and involvement and the department. In saying that, you suggested, which would be the only major difference I saw from this time and last time, you suggested that the department should probably be involved throughout the whole process, so that when the commission, when the BRTF gives us alternatives, that they're involved in all those alternatives, and their work is part of them, so that we don't have three alternatives and then a department package, and all of a sudden everybody's surprised by the department. I want the department in every one of the meetings. I know maybe we don't have staff to do that. I want the department to be part of the alternative suggestions, and I'd love to see the commission staff doing that too. That's in the perfect world. So I guess I'm not asking you. I'm saying thanks for the suggestion. I'd like to ask Sankey, how do you think that would work? And I'm personally thinking it would work better. And what do you think about that?
Good morning, Commissioners. President Flores. John did an excellent job of summarizing a lot of the key lessons learned and kind of the adjustments we see making in this process. And to recap, because it's very important for the commissioners to understand what you're getting and what you're not getting, the BRTF will be presenting you the alternative MPA proposals directly without the department acting as an in-between. The department will be providing comments and recommendations on these proposals directly to the commission. However, the department will not be generating its own preferred alternative. That's a very important point you understand. So you don't look at us later going, what's your preferred alternative? We will not have one. The good news, and the reason we think this is feasible, aside from the things we learned in the first process, is the department will be playing a much more significant role with the task force, the science advisory team, and the regional stakeholder groups, including, among other things, developing some feasibility criteria for all those groups, so we hopefully are more efficient at producing viable alternatives for you to consider. This, of course, all be made possible by the generous support by the governor and the legislature this budget year, by allowing the department to vest 11 additional PYs and a patrol captain specifically on the planning process. So we're going to have a much more direct, visible presence and participation. In addition to additional staff and several million dollars for implementation. So that's really going to allow us to have that additional involvement you were describing, Commissioner Hattori.
Yeah, and I just the future packages, yeah, I think would be better products with that type of early and often involvement. And because I'll quiet down after this. I felt uncomfortable last time with all of a sudden there was a department package, which absolutely was necessary during the way we did it last time, because the department had both a legal and a technical and resource reason to be involved. But I felt at times I was battling a department suggestion, which I don't want to ever have to do in a way. I mean, I'll do it if I need to, but I would rather have it be part of the big thing and not a different proposal. So we're saying the same thing, and I think that's a very good suggestion that every alternative will be part. Well, your folks will be part of. So hopefully that's a good thing. Thank you.
Any other questions from the commission?
Well, mine was, I can't tell up here, I can't hear anything.
Yes,
so
sure.
If it means that it's going to bring, when you bring packages to us, there's going to be better consensus, then I'm for that. I mean, that's what I want to see. What I don't want to see, and my fear has been in the past, is that sort of the commission abdicates its authority to the BRTF or whoever. And I sort of got that sense this last time when we sort of went through this process, and I want to try to avoid that. Because BRTF and everybody else has done their work, that doesn't mean that we just sort of walk away and say, well, okay, they did it. We don't have to do anything about it. We don't have to investigate it. We don't have to listen to public testimony on it. I think if had there been a better, stronger consensus, I think certainly we could have done that this time around. But whatever we can do to make it smoother and have better buy-in by all stakeholders, then we should do that.
And that's the goal of the department, is by being able to be more involved and play a more significant role early in the process. So hopefully the BRTF can bring you alternatives that we all agree on, and you just go through your deliberative process at that point with a lot less contention right. and arguments. That's all of our goals. We don't need to cause any more grief than we already do.
Cindy? And Commissioner Flores, I do think that the recommendations, including our commission staff itself being more involved, will and the commission actually being more involved in more frequent meetings will go a long ways in resolving that concern that the commission came in at the end without the background. I did want to make a comment both to Chairman Eisenberg and John Curlin and your staff that we would not be where we're today without the Blue Ribbon Task Force and the professionalism of and the wealth of experience and knowledge in policy development that came from that group. This commission could not handle the duties to have gone through that process in that manner and to have a result today that we're dealing with. So hats off to you. Thank you very much for your leadership and professionalism in getting through a very difficult process. I've never seen a process that the state engaged in with more stakeholder involvement, and I think we as a commission have to thank everybody involved, from the SAT members to the regional stakeholders group, as well as the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and all of your input and lessons learned. And I know we're going to be taking more public testimony on these issues as well to hear your further thoughts on that, because some of you don't necessarily agree with these recommendations. But I think this lessons learned process is incredibly valuable to me as a commissioner. Sitting up here, I was new. I was the newest member, and going through this process and trying to come up to speed in a relatively short period of time with an issue of such magnitude, of such importance to the state, we needed a task force. We needed people focused on this effort, and I do appreciate the department's willingness to also look at how we handle things and what we can do better in the future, so that we're more effective throughout the process, so that the stakeholders understand enforcement issues. Certainly the realities of our budget and the budget that you're facing and those sorts of things need to be brought up, and I know they were, but with commission staff and department staff at those meetings, I think some of those issues can be further addressed as we go through the process. But again, thanks for everything that you've done, and the outcome is really due to your efforts, so thank you.
Mr. Carlson, who's next? Can do any public speaking?
Actually, I'm sorry, I concluded, but I have a question for Mr. Curlin, if that's okay. You made a recommendation that the stakeholder group be smaller, and I do have a fair amount of experience in the Tahoe Basin with consensus building, and what we found throughout many processes is the minute we started limiting membership on committees, we went through more battles than we did when we just really allowed everyone their day and to participate. And what we found and what I've experienced personally is through that process, you have a pretty successful opportunity to really educate, inform, and help broaden people's perspectives. They may come with a narrow perspective, but through the process itself, you may open their eyes to some other perspectives. So I would hate to see us be too restrictive. I think that I'd rather see us be more inclusive if possible.
I appreciate that, counsel, and I share the experience and belief that if people are excluded, then they fight to get in, they feel alienated, and that's a bad outcome. And so I think we're entering this process with a hope that we can get to a smaller group. The characters I talked about, broader representation, et cetera, that what broader representation means, I think, will be really important, and multiple opportunities for input. Because if a person who does have that particular interest of the examples I gave, if they don't see that somehow brought into the process, either through their voice or someone else's voice, then they'll feel alienated. And so I think we're committed to the same outcome. It is our hope as we start this process to work toward a smaller RSG as a recommendation. But that's also partly why we suggested starting a two-month dialogue, really, with to leading in the creation of that regional stakeholder group. And if you find you're unable to get to that smaller number, I share your judgment that it's better to have the larger number and make certain you have the right constitution. But I think if we can work toward identifying both individuals and mechanisms for inclusion that does achieve broader representation instead of someone saying, if my small interest isn't there, it's a failure, that'd be a huge achievement. And so I think it's worth trying.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add, because this is very important, I think, and it fits into what Commissioner Gustafson and President Flores said. Consensus and inclusivity is all very important, and we need to do that. And whether there be 30 members, 60 members, or 10 members, the work of getting everyone's opinion heard is a big challenge, because obviously there's a difference between being heard and being agreed with, and we see that all the time. But regardless of whether there's 10 members and 5 chances of input before a BRTF decision, those who don't feel heard will show up here, and they have every right to, and that's how democracy works. And that's sort of what happened in the tsunami, if you will, of 12-hour meetings that we had before. Everybody who did or didn't feel heard came before us because we knew, in the famous words of our president, that we were the deciders. And so let's get everybody involved.
Not this president.
I know. not this president, of course, the other one. But you know what I'm saying. We need to get it done, as messy as it is on the ground. Democracy isn't pretty sometimes. And but the results have to be, everybody has to be heard. They don't have to be agreed with.
Yeah, and two observations. I think people will state their same goal and interest multiple times in the process, and I think that's fully legitimate, and I expect that, and so I would expect things, even if they've been very fully voiced at several points in the process, highly likely to come again before the commission, because you are the final decision makers. I think a slightly different angle on this is we're advantaged with the goal of bringing alternative packages to you and a recommended alternative. Because as opposed to only a single consensus package, because if there's only a single consensus package, the stakes are still huge in which is the preferred alternative. But what you have, as you saw, I think, in my judgment about the Central Coast Project, you had a set of balancing of interests, which is a normal public policy process. It's what the commission ultimately must do. It's what the BRTF did as it went through. It's what the RSG did as it went through its process to try to accommodate different interests. And one and adherence to one package or another will commonly believe theirs is the best alternative. Anything else is inappropriate, but it is a balancing of interest in each of those. And my judgment is we're advantaged in this process by having alternative packages come forward.
Commission, Sankey Master of Fish and Game. I would like to follow up on a comment President Flores made regarding concerns about advocating. I just want to make clear the department in no way is going to or interested in advocating or abandoning its statutory obligation for resource management and protection. And you know the department well enough. We won't let that happen, and we won't let you let that happen to you either. That's something we all are committed to. So just to make it clear that we think this process will work just fine without any risk of that. If you have any
Great.
Questions.
Thank you.
I guess I have a question, and I'm not sure this can be answered by you or you know, obviously we've set aside these marine reserves, and as we go forward in the future, we've removed people from the water, and we've done our best in terms of protecting that resource, protecting that habitat. But how do we, as we go forward, look at other factors that play a significant role in terms of either stock depletions or loss of habitat, such as air pollution, water pollution, other impacts onto the resources? Will you guys be making any recommendations in the future as to some other areas that we ought to be looking at, as opposed to just setting aside waters?
As you know, President Flores, we have a lot of sister agencies that have responsibilities in some of those venues, and that's something we will have to be looking at much more aggressively as we keep developing this network of reserves, or developing the network of reserves, and really start with the monitoring, start really kind of figuring out how to enhance and improve and deal with some impacts. And it will include things like discharge from storm drains, et cetera. And we will be working with those responsible parties to figure out how to help deal with that, because it makes no sense to deliver half the loaf.
I see this as an extremely complex issue, and I think we need a far-reaching comprehensive plan. If we're going to do this and make this work, we need to look at every aspect impact to these resources, and not just removing a few fishermen, a few divers, and a few commercial fishermen. So, the BRTF went further in some of its recommendations, such as one of the staff recommendations for the commission. I'm wondering if they would venture into that and maybe go out on a limb and make some of those recommendations in the future as they're discovering what some of these issues are.
Yeah,
Mr. Carlin.
Yeah. I can't speak for them, but I will just say that, as you well know, the MLPA process is an adaptive one, and this is simply the first step of many adaptations to achieving the goals.
I'm sorry, you asked a question, but I was going to add something.
You wanted to answer it?
No, I was going to. Okay. Well, I want to add to your question in the sense of I agree with everything you said. And then the question will be, how do we fix this? But the whole concept of the MLPA is for a system of reserves, ecosystem protection. But absolutely, Mr. Gearing has come before this commission and said this from the perspective of the Fishing Coalition, and Mr. Flores just mentioned it, and I know Mr. Rogers and I have mentioned water quality before. Obviously, the depletion of fisheries and the status quo came about not just from overfishing and different kinds of management than we have now, but from all kind of other factors of water quality and non-point source pollution and air quality and overpopulation and development along the coast. And, it's probably 10 lists. And I know that in the legislative findings of the MLPA, they've mentioned all these things. But, of course, the law then said we're responsible for the system of reserves and the ecosystem management side of things. And I, too, am concerned with the other things. I know this commission can't do that. I also know that California has the best non-point source pollution laws now. We have new laws on climate change, on global warming, on mileage standards, on coal-powered plants that deal with mercury, which is, the number one cause of why mercury is in the water. All of these things need to be addressed by the Air Quality Board, the Water Resources Board, local planning departments, and of course, taking a holistic, look at this is going to take more than just having the Fish and Game Commission take action on MPAs. I support all of that being done. We don't have the authority to do that. We're not the Homeland Security Department that has authority over everything. But I think everybody has to keep that in mind, that those other issues have to also be addressed. And I know a lot of the activists out here, there's people that work on water quality. And I think the fishing industry has to work on water quality more. I think the environmental community has to work on development issues more, on and on and on. And so my comments combined with Mr. Flores's, and I don't think you're responsible for this answer, but is we need to just keep it in mind that we need to have joint and meetings with other groups and push our other regulatory bodies to take action also. So do you have any ideas on how we can do that, is my question.
Someone else will be at the podium soon to answer these questions. But only a couple of observations, because I think there's a real challenges here, and the challenges are not uncommon in public policy processes, because decision arenas and statutory authorities are fragmented. And so what you have before you as the Fish and Game Commission is a suite of tools you have. And today we're talking about the MLPA, and later you may talk about MLMA, but you're not talking about forestry practices. You're not talking about what's happening in areas that are well known to influence what's happening in the ocean. Let me just mention, and I think that's just the character of our policy process, and at one level it's inescapable. What we've attempted to do in the Central Coast, and I think we can improve on in future study regions, are two things. One is to try to get the best information possible about the impacts of these other factors. And water quality is an example. In the Central Coast, even, we look for evidence of all the discharges and any sort of deleterious impact on the ocean that could be localized. And not only discharges, but the heat plumes out of Diablo Canyon, et cetera. So that process is ongoing. We're very committed to and working very hard to make certain we have all the best information about impacts that can be identified affecting the areas that in which we're trying to design MLPAs, or trying to implement the MLPA. So that's the first thing. The other thing we're doing, I think we're that was done in the Central Coast. I think actually the challenge is as you move south or north are likely to be larger, particularly as you move south, where you have more dischargers. And so the interests affected, and we'll probably have more information, and it'll be more consequential possibly in the design of MPAs than it was in the Central Coast project, which is going through your rulemaking process now. The other thing we're doing, I think, with this extending the iterations through which packages are developed and are visible invites more comment by other parties. It turns out that the MLPA, you may remember, by statute includes representation of the State Water Resources Control Board and the Parks Department on the Science Advisory Team, which is, in my judgment, ends up being an odd place to have them participating in the process. So we've had conversations just a couple days ago with the parks people, which isn't germane to this issue about water quality, but germane to some other issues of design of MPAs and human uses, about them being involved in different ways and get their inputs more routinized into the process. And I think that's what we need to do with all these other potential factors. I think the best that can come out of something that is under the MLPA, in my judgment, is making as much visible as possible. And so that you, the decision makers, who will have partial responsibility only, because I said you can't control forestry practices, to the best of my knowledge anyway, you understand what we're able to understand about the impacts.
Yeah. I think that's it. We have a brief moment where we have a really bright light shine on us and on this process, and when we can, enlighten folks to there are other issues, that we ought to take that opportunity. So that's why I asked. So thank you very much.
We'll move to the next agenda item now. And like I said, we're going to hold public comment for both items till the end. And the next item is a report by J. Michael Hardy addressing socioeconomic considerations in the next MLPA study region. I was going to let John Curlin give a little intro to this. This was a report funded by the BRTF in an effort to, I think, link to the lessons learned, basically.
Yeah. As we noted in going through, one of the lessons learned was a recommendation that to the extent possible, more information be provided about relationship with fisheries and MLPA and socioeconomic considerations. In discussions with commissioners and with the task force members, we agreed to fund a project to try to frame choices about socioeconomic considerations as they come to the commission. And the intent was, and I think the report is true to this, not make a specific recommendation, but rather frame the range of choices that were available to you. And the scope of work developed for Michael Hardy, who I'll speak about in a moment, we asked first that he also accurately reflect what was done in the Central Coast Project, and then identify the critiques of that and sort through possible ways to respond to those critiques, and the intent was what we talked about as a decision memo. Here's if you want to make a decision, here's the area, here's the place to talk about and consider making a different recommendation from the commission. J. Michael Hardy, whom I met only several months ago, when we retained him to be one of our external lessons learned clients, has good skills for this task in that he's broadly experienced in policymaking, and he's not a social scientist. I have far too much personal experience in these wars to probably be objective wholly about it. And I'm not talking specifically about the Central Coast Project, but just 4 decades of working in public policy and bringing socioeconomic information in. But Michael has done, I think, a good job of both describing what was done on the Central Coast and framing the critiques in a way that can be informative to the commission, and then identifying 3 areas in which you could make decisions.
Good morning, Mr. President, commissioners, and staff. I'm Mike Hardy, and I want to say that I've had the privilege of assisting the initiative in developing some lessons learned as an external evaluator. I did not have any role in the initiative process or the Central Coast Project, and I'm glad that Chairman Eisenberg, even though he's left, still thinks it was a good idea to develop lessons learned. I do want to tie this to the first report that I did along with my co-author, DeWitt John. One of the areas that we focused on were the numerous critical perspectives about the way socioeconomic information was treated on the Central Coast. And so one of the recommendations we developed, and certainly one that the Blue Ribbon Task Force focused on, was socioeconomics. And then this report, which I prepared, I think demonstrates the maxim that no constructive criticism goes unpunished. And so as John Kierlin said, what I have tried to do in this report is not to recommend to you a specific path through the landscape of socioeconomics. It seemed to me, based on the conversations that I had with 9 of the various social scientists expert in this area, and also I want to acknowledge that John Ugaritz and Paul Riley helped me, although I know they don't agree with me, and I appreciate that in all cases. And also in my exposure to the views of the stakeholders and others during the initiative, it seemed to me that it would be useful to try and tee up for you, to use sort of a golf metaphor, some decisions that are potentially before you, and to identify some basic options that you could think about. But I have no illusions or expectation that those are the only options, or that that any decision that you would make would adhere precisely to the way I've organized it. It's just there clearly was a framework lacking here for the conversation about socioeconomics, and so this is intended really as the first step toward creating some organization and helping you as the decision makers to provide whatever guidance you think is appropriate in this area. I also want to acknowledge that Commissioner Rogers, who's not here today, has a particular interest in this area. I did speak with him, along with Commissioner Hatoy, as part of your Marine Committee, and I regret that we won't be able to talk a little further about this today, but I'm quite happy to do that at some later point if that would be useful. Okay. So I have a few slides. I promise it's much shorter than the report that I gave you. I have to confess that I'm probably responsible for 2/3 of the bulk of the paper that you received for this meeting, and I don't really know what else to say about that. Okay. So here's what I thought I would do is take a tour through the report. And then I will spend as much time as is useful for you answering questions. The first part of the report is intended to describe generally the approach that the initiative took to socioeconomics. As John Kierlin said, I thought it was important to try and lay down with reasonable accuracy what happened. I suspect that from the perspective of any particular stakeholder or participant in the process, there may be elements that are not quite consistent with their thinking, but I'm willing to endure that. I think I've got it, and I hope I've got it generally right, but I also know that I'll be corrected as far as any gaps. The second thing I wanted to do is I'd focus on 4 critiques that I have picked up from all the public comment and conversations that I've had. And what I did do to try and provoke conversation is ask whether a different approach than was followed is likely to have made a difference in your decision making for the Central Coast. And that is intended to extend both to the stakeholder level, the Blue Ribbon Task Force level, as well as potentially to your own. Again, I know that you have not made a final decision, but I thought I'd wander around out there anyway, again, in hopes of stimulating discussion. And I fully expect that there are going to be different views about this and that you'll hear from them. But if you do, that will have met my goal, because I would like people to ask that question. Then what I have done is identified three decisions along with three options for each one of the decisions. And I've used four evaluation criteria, namely, what are the legal requirements and are they relevant? How would this be useful to you in making your decision? How would this be useful to stakeholders? And what would be the availability of any information in terms of timeliness and whether it would be cost effective? What would be the payoff here? I'm going to talk a little bit later about something that was referenced earlier, and that is the misalignment in terms of the timing of the stakeholder group and the availability of information. If you're going to ask for experts to do work, there are very important lead times that they need, and they've been pretty explicit about that with me. I don't have a perfect sense of those, and I know that you can get better information from people, but availability of information is going to be a very important factor. There are two attachments to the report. The first is a compilation of socioeconomic information that was compiled during the Central Coast process. And what I tried to do is array it in a way that gives you a sense of when information was available and who it was available to. I know it could be commented upon if someone chose to that the commission had all the information, but the fact is that it would be if you look at the volume of information that was developed, it in my judgment is not realistic to expect you as commissioners to go through every sentence or every data point. So it seems to me it's reasonable for you to be able to rely on the review of information that has gone on in earlier processes without, as the president indicated, abdicating your responsibility. I think there's a balance there. Obviously, one of the things that's very important is if your staff are going to be asked to do more, you need the resources to do that, because this table is intended to show just in 12 pages just how much information was out there. I suspect there will be even more in future study regions. Attachment B is a memorandum that was prepared by the initiative staff for the Blue Ribbon Task Force to try and identify the approach to socioeconomics for the Central Coast project. It was intended as a summary rather than as a document that was prepared at the beginning to guide decision making. So it reflected the approach to socioeconomics that developed. And I'm happy to answer questions along the way, but I'll just kind of proceed through this. If you'd like me to move more quickly, please let me know. But I know that there's a lot of information in this report. I had hoped to make it about 10 pages, but once I got into this, it became clear to me that part of the reason for the criticism around this subject is that it's very complicated. And I think the social scientists are certainly aware of that, and they shake their heads sometimes at people who try and simplify it. And I decided that it would not do justice to the subject, particularly since I'm trying to organize this in a way that to provoke a conversation to oversimplify it. And the result was what you got, a lot of pages. Okay. The basic approach that the initiative took to socioeconomics, that as I have summarized it, is that information availability increased as the decisions moved from the stakeholders to the Blue Ribbon Task Force through the department and to you. Ultimately, the descriptive information that was developed was available to everyone in the sense that I'm not aware of any significant descriptive information about the activities along the Central Coast that you have that was not eventually available to the stakeholders. The difference was that the timing of that information for the stakeholders became really problematic because they didn't have it early in their process, and as a result, some of that information that they got very late was treated as not useful, and I know that there was a lot of comments that they wish they had had the information sooner. There was also a difference in the evaluation information. You and the Blue Ribbon Task Force had more evaluative information than the stakeholders did. Their information was quite limited in that area. The initiative's approach was tied very tightly and intentionally to the language and their reading of the Marine Life Protection Act. They gave precedence to ecosystem integrity and to habitat protection goals. I'm going to state what many people have said, and my framing may not be consistent with other people's preferences, but socioeconomics, in the way the initiative approached it, has a lower priority in decision-making about MPA design. The initiative did not take the position that had no relevance, but it was clearly and consistently a lower priority. And there was a lot of struggle with how to explain this, and there was not clarity about exactly how to do it. The personal knowledge of stakeholders was, consistent with the statute, valued very highly, and there was a belief that a lot of information that was important around the question of socioeconomics, both in terms of what activities were going on in the study region, as well as what the potential impacts could be of a particular design, were brought to the process by the stakeholders. The importance of this obviously will be relevant to the design of the next stakeholder group. So this is one of the things that I think will be of interest to people. If you're going to rely on stakeholder input and personal knowledge, which the statute specifies, how do you make sure you do that when you're structuring the input process? And finally, there were some basic technical limitations that social scientists have educated me about. They are much more qualified than I to explain them, but I did try and explain what some of those were. It simply was not possible or practical, particularly within the time frames that existed, to provide information that had enough spatial relevance to be useful in designing MPAs. There are still going to be some challenges in that area going forward, but I also believe that there are some ideas out there from the social scientists for you. As I said, the information in Attachment A compiles the information that was the table there compiles the information that was done. The initiative didn't just deal with existing information. They did issue some contracts to gather new information and do some analysis. I think the estimate that we came up with was about $365,000 was spent to do that. The best known was the work by EcoTrust. I know you're familiar with the work of EcoTrust, and that focus was on commercial and recreational fisheries. There also was some work done to evaluate non-consumptive activities in the Monterey Bay region. That was done by some social scientists. Okay. So, critiques of this approach. The first critique that I identified has to do with the initiative's interpretation of the statute and the requirements of the MLPA. It's a little bit difficult in this context to generalize about the views of all the consumptive users or all the non-consumptives, and I want to acknowledge that, but I'm going to make some generalizations here because there are some tendencies that I've seen. Some consumptive users felt that the initiative's interpretation of the statute as placing priority on satisfying biophysical criteria was unduly narrow and inflexible and ultimately unfair. There has been advocacy for a balancing of biophysical benefits against socioeconomic impacts. You can see and hear in some of the comments that really what fairness suggests is that you should, yes, try and achieve your biophysical benefits, but it's really a balancing that is required. To the extent necessary, information wasn't readily available in order to allow you to do this balancing. I think that people would argue that you should gather the information, and if you have to wait, you should wait and make sure you have all the information that you need in order to be able to actually balance benefits biologically against socioeconomic impacts and then draw a conclusion. That's one critique of the approach. I would say that many non-consumptive users as well as environmental stakeholders would not agree with that approach, and they generally supported the approach that the initiative took. I would say that that group would resist interpretation of the MLPA as requiring a balancing. It's not in the language of the statute. I think that I have heard, you know, if you go to the extreme, and I think this was reflected in some of the packages that were actually developed, some would argue that the MLPA actually is a benefit-maximizing statute, and that the obligation actually is to maximize the ecosystem benefits, and that you can't actually reduce benefits in order to address socioeconomic impacts, that you have to focus very tightly on achieving biophysical benefits. And I think that one of the packages that you saw, Package AC, that was referred to, in some sense could be seen as reflecting this interpretation of what the statute requires. When you looked at EquiTrust analysis of the impacts of that package, you saw that it had the greatest impacts as well in terms of area as well as impacts on relative value. The regional goals and objectives that were negotiated by the stakeholders and eventually adopted by the task force, in my judgment, captured the uncertainty about what the statute intends. There is an objective to minimize negative socioeconomic impacts and optimize positive socioeconomic impacts to all users to the extent possible, and if consistent with the MLPA. Those last two clauses highlight the questions that are out there, and they're one of the reasons why it strikes me that this is a decision for the Commission. Do you want to do something about understanding the way the MLPA ought to be interpreted going forward in order to address some of the criticism and controversy and concerns that have been expressed about how the statute is interpreted and the way it was interpreted the last time? When I asked the question, would a different interpretation, would a different approach have influenced decision making, I think the answer is yes. And as I mentioned, Package AC might have made it to you if the MLPA were interpreted as requiring a maximization of biophysical benefits. I also believe that if the MLPA were interpreted as requiring a balancing approach, you would have seen different characteristics in the packages, and I suspect, for example, that Package 1, which was more of an effort to balance and had the least biophysical benefits but also did the most to try and minimize socioeconomic impacts, may have generated more support than it did. So I think that a different approach would be significant, and that's why, again, I think it merits attention by the Commission. Second critique of the Central Coast Project has to do with the amount and the quality of information about human activity, economic value, and impacts. And Commissioner Rogers did ask, and I think I have a reasonably good quote, well, why don't we have a good spatial understanding of all human activity in the study region, both consumptive or non-consumptive? Why don't we know what's going on out there? A fair question. And there is no debate that there are gaps in this information for the Central Coast, and you will, depending on work that's done in anticipation of future study regions, face the same question potentially for future study regions. There are gaps in information about commercial fisheries. As you know, the state does not have a program that provides objective data, either through transponders or otherwise, for the commercial fisheries on the Central Coast. You can obviously get a lot more information about that from the department's experts. But the gaps don't apply just to commercial fisheries. They apply to recreational fisheries. They apply to non-consumptive activities. There have not been data collection efforts ongoing either on the Central Coast or elsewhere that have been robust to actually try and paint the picture of all the human activity that potentially has value and ought to be part of an accounting if you're looking for an accounting of value in a study region. It just hasn't been there. And it wasn't there for the Central Coast. One interesting point here is that, you know, you've heard that the Marine Life Protection Act requires the use of the best scientifically available information. This standard has been applied to socioeconomic information. And so what that has meant in terms of the way the initiative interpreted it was, timeliness is an important criterion here, and you use the best information that you've got, even if it's not the information you wish you had, and you don't wait to gather information. This has generated a lot of controversy, and it's generated frustration, particularly from people who say, our lives are going to be impacted by a decision that you make, and it's not fair for you to make that decision if you don't have information. You need to gather the information. That's been one of the sources of controversy and criticism here. I think that non-consumptive users have also criticized the lack, relatively, of socioeconomic information. One interesting thing that was pointed out to me is that there's a basic assumption that if you're a kayaker or a diver or a non-consumptive user, you're going to benefit from creation of MPA, so who cares? We don't need to spend money. But it was suggested to me that that is just an assumption. It actually has not been demonstrated, at least to the satisfaction of academics who demand some rigor around this. Now, that may provoke a range of comment to you, but what's been pointed out to me by social scientists is it is an assumption. It's out there. To some extent, the non-consumptive community was laboring under it, but it actually has not necessarily been demonstrated. And again, I think that there are some very practical methodological problems in this area. There are differences among the experts about the kind of information you need. There are social scientists who say, and I wanted to put this direct quote up there. Let's see, do I have this backward? I'm sorry. Oh, they kind of take a basic approach to planning, which is what you're doing, and they say, if you've got 50 fishermen fishing in one place versus 5 fishermen, that's enough information. You know what you have to do. You have to pay attention to that area and the potential impacts you could cause by including that area in an MPA. And you don't need to go through an elaborate, resource-intensive data-gathering exercise. You just focus there. You talk to the people who fish there. You talk to other potential users. And you use that as a hot spot or a high-value spot. But you don't need to go into a more extensive data-gathering and time-intensive exercise. There are obviously other points of view that you need to have a little bit more rigor than personal information in trying to paint that picture. But I did hear a range of views from social scientists about how much information you need, and I suspect that if you ask them, you're going to get a range of views from them about their methodologies, what they think is adequate. It's inevitable. One of the things that I wanted to touch on is, for those folks who are actually arguing for more information in addition to the things that you've heard, there are some other arguments or suggestions that I heard. The first is, if you spend more time and gather more data, it will actually limit some of the extreme assertions that you will hear or that may be made in front of the Blue Ribbon Task Force or even within the stakeholder group. So there may be some payoff there. Secondly, it was suggested to me that if you design MPAs on the basis of estimating maximum potential economic impact, that is an oversimplification. And you really do need greater complexity when you're looking at that, because those negative impacts can affect economic well-being. The process and the potential impacts deserves a better measure than just maximum potential economic impacts. Third, it was suggested that better information can actually help you as commissioners, as well as, to the extent the Blue Ribbon Task Force does it, make some decisions about fairness and equity. If you lack that information, then you're getting just personal comments from people. If there's a better picture painted, you're in a better position to try and think through what fairness and equity require. What it have made a difference if you had better data in this area. Here's what strikes me. The MLPA focuses very heavily on biophysical criteria, and those wouldn't have changed. They're a priority, and they would remain a priority. And my understanding from talking to people is that there were extensive efforts made to model ways to reduce socioeconomic impacts, but they always came up against the biophysical criteria. And to the extent that those are a priority, there are limitations on what you can do, even if you have more information. Secondly, it seems to me that it's debatable whether the treatment of individual, commercial, or recreational fishermen would change. I know that you have made efforts, and you've heard from individual fishermen or particular fisheries about sort of disproportionate impacts that resulted from drawing lines in certain places. It's not obvious to me that the outcome of decision-making would have been different. I think it's debatable, which means you're going to hear it from people on both sides. I don't have an opinion about what the ultimate result would have been. I think the basic working assumption that MPAs benefit non-consumptive users means that you could gather all this rich information about what the activity is, how many kayakers are here, how many divers are there, but I don't think that it would have significantly changed the decisions. That information was brought into the stakeholder process, based on what I understand, in a very significant way, in a very personal way. It put a lot of load on the shoulders of the people who had to do it, but it was there. Now, it may have made a difference, again, on the margin, but based on what I have heard, it doesn't appear that it would have made a significant difference in the outcomes. It seems to me also that equity and fairness have been on your minds. It certainly, they were on the minds of the BRTF. If you recall, the task force sent both Package 1 and Package 2 proponents back, and in particular, the Package 2 proponents, which was viewed as sort of the environmental package, they were told you need to address socioeconomic impacts. So that effort to deal with equity and fairness occurred both at the task force as well as by you. I do think there would have been a significant impact on the process of developing packages if there more of this information were available. But that's different from a significant impact on the outcome. The third critique has to do with the access of the Blue Ribbon Task Force, stakeholders to information. There were three barriers that the stakeholders complained of. The first was timing. Their timing, their work schedule didn't align with availability of information. One example is the regional goals and objectives. The stakeholders started meeting in June. The final version of the regional goals and objectives was available in September, and it had different information than was available earlier in the process. I know John Corlin has addressed this and that they really want to pay attention to this in the next study area, but that was a source of criticism. The second had to do with confidentiality. I know you've heard a lot about this, but the stakeholders had very limited access to information from the EcoTrust study. They really couldn't get a look at the maps that identified the valuable fishing areas, and that was a source of frustration. There was a process that was kind of cobbled together to provide some information, but it wasn't satisfactory to the stakeholders. And I have my sense is that that also can be addressed based on the conversations that I've had with the experts in the next study region. The third has to do with who gets descriptive information versus evaluation information and who needs it. There was concern that the stakeholders didn't have the same quality of information, particularly evaluative information, that was available to the task force or to you. For example, they did not have all the EcoTrust analysis. They didn't have Dr. Willen's analysis, and they certainly didn't have the work that the department did in terms of the actual economic value and the dollar values associated with different fisheries and different subregions. It wasn't available to them. So it raises a couple of questions. Do you think that the stakeholders need to have information at that level and that everyone ought to have all the same information from the beginning, or is it reasonable for the stakeholders to have more descriptive information and let the evaluative information come from the products later in the process? I think it's a basic choice. Would it have made a difference if there, the timing and confidentiality and the types of data were addressed or approached differently? Again, I think the process would have been different. I think it's debatable whether the packages 1, 2, or 3 would have changed substantially based on timing and confidentiality. It seems to me that the information made its way into the packages, not in the way that people would have preferred, but it got there. I think changing the BRTF feedback could have influenced the result. If you see in the recommendations for the next study region, they're talking about multiple iterations between the task force and the stakeholders. That's what I'm getting at here. I think if they had had multiple iterations and the task force had been able to actually talk directly and react directly to the stakeholders, you would have had differences in the content of the packages. They would have moved along differently. I'm not sure that more evaluation information would have made a difference at the stakeholder level, again, because I believe there was a lot of personal knowledge about potential impacts brought to that process. There was probably half the seats on the stakeholder group were for fishing fishermen, and obviously everyone has personal knowledge. They have knowledge in their heads about where they fish, but it's my sense that most of that information made its way there. I'm not sure how much this would have influenced your decision making. It doesn't seem to me to have been significant. The fourth critique is that there's no framework or structure for socioeconomics. I don't think there's any debate about that. The experts underlined it for me. You had a framework developed by the science advisory team for biophysical criteria. They got to design guidelines and criteria, and they had a way to evaluate these various MPAs. You didn't have an equivalent framework for socioeconomic impacts. You did have a master plan framework, but if you actually review what's in the master plan framework, there's not any content. It's do this. There's steps. Pay attention to socioeconomics, but it doesn't have the kind of content that you had in the SAT guidelines. One interesting thing that you might want to pay attention to, there is a project going on at UC Santa Barbara, and the science advisory team and others are paying attention to it, that uses a software tool called Marksan that's a decision support tool. And that I mention this because that kind of tool has assumptions and has a framework implicit in it. And so if you don't get to a framework, you're going to get to one, I think, eventually, because of the attraction of various decision support tools to social scientists as well as the physical scientists. Again, as far as whether having a clear framework for socioeconomics would have influenced the outcome, I think it could have reduced conflict and controversy if everyone knew what the rules were. Then they could have argued about the specific rules, but not just fired various salvos about the general inadequacy of the socioeconomic approach. Basic agreements about data collection and analysis would have helped. More peer review could be part of a framework, so I think that also could have helped. And you could also then link that to MLP interpretation. So again, I think there could have been a significant difference, particularly in the process, if you had a framework. Okay, real quickly, here are the three decisions that I've identified. The first is, do you want to address the absence of what I'd say is an authoritative interpretation of the MLPA? The options that I identified were, you could seek some sort of an advisory opinion, either from the department or from the Attorney General. I think that you could adopt the MLPA initiative's approach as captured in the memorandum that's in Attachment B. You could modify that memorandum to clarify certain things if you chose to. But some sort of endorsement of a basic overall approach to socioeconomics is a second choice. And I think the third is, don't do anything and focus instead on dealing with specific options for addressing socioeconomics in the next study region. So that would be creating a policy step by step as you deal with specific issues like, do we need more information about commercial fisheries? Do we need more information about non-consumptive activity? Those are the three basic choices that I identified. I'm aware that the department has provided some information to you from their general counsel about the requirements of the MLPA, and I also know that there is some resistance to the notion of actually seeking an advisory opinion. Since I finished my report, I've been better educated about what would be involved in getting an advisory opinion. And I think that what I would point out is that, unlike in the federal system where there tends to be a very detailed legislative history, you don't have that in California in most cases. And so when a lawyer is asked to interpret a statute that's kind of murky on a certain subject, they don't have a lot of landmarks, the same kind of quality of landmarks that you have in the federal system. And so this makes lawyers in government somewhat resistant to stepping out there and interpreting the gray areas of statutes. I think there's an opinions unit in the AG's office that these requests for opinions sometimes go to. When you get it and what you get out is unpredictable. It's kind of a black box process, according to what I've been told. And so I had this educational experience after I completed my report, and so I think that if I were to do anything, I would just add a little more clarity about the uncertainty of what you might get out of a request for a legal opinion. The second decision that I identified for you is, and I'll try and keep up here, is what are your preferences substantively for the approach to Seconomics in the next study region? I think that you could do three basic things. You could endorse the approach that the Central Coast took and make a couple of minor modifications. But basically, that would mean focus on biophysical criteria, fill specific data gaps, but be very judicious in expending resources. Don't ask for creation of a socioeconomic framework. Anticipate that you're going to have criticism and controversy, but understand that the priority is for biophysical, meeting biophysical criteria. Let stakeholders bring personal information into the process again, and rely on the process to bring that information into some sort of rough balance. I think the second thing you could do is really try and adopt some very specific modifications to the approach. You could request specific steps be taken to address different kinds of information. And that may require some expert input and stakeholder advice to you. And I think the third thing you could do is what the experts would suggest, and that is ask the experts to develop a basic framework for you and use that then to guide the request for specific products. I want to look at option B2 because what I did here is I tried to actually predict for you what the experts are likely to tell you. So the first product you could ask for substantively would be a comprehensive accounting of socioeconomic activity in the study region. Step one, and I would say that all the experts agreed, we need to know what's going on in the study region. We have to do a better job, and we can do a better job about what the various activities are. This has nothing to do with an accounting or trying to estimate the value of those activities, but just what are the activities. There seem to me to be four things that you could do, and I built this with the experts, and that is you could describe all recreational fishing activity in the study region. You charter, private, and shore. What you would do is you'd use existing state survey data. You would do a random telephone survey, and then you would do location-specific interviews. You'd follow that up by using focus groups and stakeholder input to validate and add detail to what the first three data gathering and analysis exercises got for you. You would focus closely on spatial data because you need to make this information relevant to the design of MPAs. It's not just about understanding activity, but you've got to understand it on a scale that you can say, well, if we draw the line here as opposed to 50 yards away, how's that going to affect diving? That's the kind of scale that you need to get the information for. What the experts told me is that you could anticipate broad support based on the information that I got. I also think you'll probably hear some different views about how you do it in the various methodologies, but generally broad support for being able to pull that off. Another thing you could do is describe all the non-consumptive activity similarly. You'd use similar tools. You don't have quite the same survey data, but random telephone surveys, location-specific interviews, focus groups, and then use the stakeholders to flesh it out. the same basic methodologies. Again, I think you could anticipate broad support for doing that. The third step has to do with commercial fishing activity. This step, because, again, there are no objective source of data for commercial fishing, would involve an enhanced interview methodology similar to that used for the Central Coast. There are a number of improvements that have been identified, not just by EcoTrust, but also by Dr. Willen and also by the CFC's review, that could be incorporated into the design of that approach. I know that people have suggested it ought to be peer-reviewed up front rather than subject to peer review after everything is finished, and there's general agreement about that. I think that there would be broad expert support for that approach, and that there would be a potential for different views about the precise methodology that you would have to sort through. Finally, a description of the total economic value of activity. Some people have said, well, in addition to knowing what's going on, we need to know what the value of all that activity is in the region if we're going to be looking at socioeconomic impacts. You know, there are different ways to do this. Different experts have different views about what goes into something like this. Some people think it's very important to focus on all the connections. So, for example, instead of focusing on a boat, you focus on each of the crew members on the boat, and you kind of track what happens to every dollar. You focus on fish processors. You focus on people who sell gas. There are different views about what goes into a painting a picture of what the total economic value is and where you need to draw the line. My judgment is that you will hear limited support for undertaking this. You'll hear some people advocate for it very strongly, and others will say, number one, it's very complicated. It's going to be very resource intensive. The results you're going to get are not going to be particularly relevant for MPA design. Now, that's different from saying that as you monitor impacts over time, that you don't want to understand what's going on. And I want to be really clear, I'm focusing on design and not what's happening over time, evaluation, monitoring, adaptive management, and those kinds of things. So that was some of the detail around option B2. Then the third option is procedural option, and you heard it referred to earlier this morning in the proposals for a greater level of engagement, both at the staff level and also at the commission level in the next study region. It seemed to me that you could do a couple of things with that in mind. The first is, as a commission, you could try and proactively develop and adopt principles yourselves that would guide the approach to socioeconomics in the next study region. I think you also have an option of basically saying, you know, we're going to kind of approach this the way we did on the Central Coast because we were comfortable with that. If another tsunami comes along, we'll just deal with it. I can sense the response to that option. And the third option strikes me as taking a more active and collaborative approach, such as has been suggested earlier this morning, by engaging with the BRTF and also at the staff level, as well as in other entities in jointly developing socioeconomic policy for the next study region. So I have also in the report very detailed tables for each one of the decisions and the options where I try to lay out what I think the criteria that I was asked to use, how they apply to each one of these choices. And rather than go through those, because I know I've been talking for a long time, I thought that if you had questions about those, I could address them. But I thought that I would leave that to your discretion. So I'll conclude my comments at this point and respond to any questions you have.
Thank you very much. Commissioners, do you have any questions at this point? Okay. All right, John, let's call up the public.
So, Michael, if you can hang around, we're going to have public comments, and then there might be some questions for you.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I did want to thank him for two-thirds of the packet because
It
came in very handy on carrying it over here this morning. But I thought it was a very thorough report and a fair analysis, and I appreciated your comments. But we will have more questions, I'm sure, after we hear from the
public. Yeah, I'll have questions. I just want to see what other folks think.
Okay, John.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have about 13 speakers today, and this is a combined comment on both agenda items, so you get a total of 3 minutes. we would like folks to, when I call your names, come up, you know, by the podium so that we can move through efficiently. First speaker will be Karen Garrison, followed by Gordon Hensley, followed by Linda Sheehan, followed by Vern Gehring.
What are we, 3 minutes? Karen Garrison, Natural Resources Defense Council. I think I just saw you folks a couple of days ago. I try to take one day at a time, but sometimes several days attack me at once. I appreciate the attention to lessons learned. I think it's a very important process, and I'll submit more detailed comments in writing. I want to just make one observation in the interest of a broader perspective. The analysis that was done and used for the Central Coast, both biological and socioeconomic, was more extensive than for any other MPA or ocean process that I'm familiar with. Likewise, the public involvement process was more extensive, and the process itself was more transparent than any other process I've been involved with. In trying to improve both the process and the type of information that's available, I think it's important not to forget just how good this process was relative to other processes of this type. The Fish and Game Commission and the Blue Ribbon Task Force, I think, have reached a new level in their ability to pay attention to and take into account the needs of a whole range of stakeholders, and I think that was a very important leap up in this process that you deserve credit for. I also wholeheartedly support the recommendation for more support for the commission in terms of staff and resources, and anything that we can do to help in that regard, we're happy to do. I want to briefly touch on the options laid out in the Hardy report, skipping the more detailed findings and going right to the decisions. On A, whether a more authoritative interpretation is needed of the role of socioeconomic information. I think the statute clearly calls for the use of the best readily available information, not for new data collection. Its goals are largely biophysical and cultural. I think the decision to collect more data is clearly a policy decision for the commission, not one driven by the requirements of the law. That said, if the commission wants a more authoritative interpretation, I think probably an opinion by the department or commission counsel is likely to be faster and more efficient than one by the attorney general. Regarding decision B, what kind of substantive approach? The Act calls, let's see, how can I shorten this? Basically, I think we agree that it would be helpful to have spatial data on the intensity and distribution of uses, including that kind of data for recreational fishing and for non-consumptive uses. We don't support the third. So basically, we would support B2, the first couple of bullets, and probably a lot of the third bullet. The data on valuation of these uses, I think, is not pertinent to the kinds of decisions we're trying to make, and it also doesn't enjoy very much expert support. And I guess I'm stopping there and hoping that someone else will cover your third decision. Thanks.
I just have one more thing before I quit.
Can I just encourage you to think about the precedent you're setting for the other kinds of regulatory processes you're involved with as you think about how to move forward on these issues? Because I think that's one really important issue. Right now, you are not encumbered by huge complex processes of data gathering for other kinds of decisions. And so to the extent you're deciding on policy about these things, think about framing it as seeking supportive information as opposed to required information and so on and so forth. I can provide you with more ideas about that.
Gordon Hensley, followed by Linda Sheehan, followed by Vern Gehring.
Good morning, Commissioners. Gordon Hensley. I'm the San Luis Obispo Coast Keeper. I was a member of the stakeholder group. The area of concern of our organization, the San Luis Obispo Coast Keeper, is virtually synonymous with the MPA study area. So we've been very interested in the entire project. I'll address some of my comments about the Hardy study, and then if we're still time, talk a little bit about the lessons learned. My major concern with the socioeconomic study of both what we received and what we are continuing to talk about is what I refer to as the so what factor. The ultimate use of this data is in the policy decision processes on the location of the MPAs. And so the data must include both consumptive and non-consumptive uses. And in the Central Coast, our experience there was that we had a major gap, especially in the non-consumptive uses. The GIS tool that we used that was available to us on the website was very helpful in putting together our packages, adding the socioeconomic data in that same GIS format available would be a great help as decisions on the locations move forward and are made. As far as the specific decisions that were that have been presented to you, on decision A, I would support option A2 or A3. Decision B, I would support option B1 or B2, and decision 3, option C1, is absolutely the worst. There's some serious risks that I see there. C2 would be preferable, C3 if you felt like you had to go there. On the lessons learned, well, if we define compromise as leaving all sides dissatisfied when we leave the room, then that was achieved. I've received a lot of grief from the local enviros all throughout the Central Coast that the preferred network does not conserve enough. And I'm sure you've heard that before. I think that the process would be helped at that point by a slightly different tack of the process and the way information came to us. I think by nature, where people are more reactive than creative, and had we had data first up front with some idea of what the scientific community saw as the best components to preserve, the best areas, that would have helped us focus, and it would have given us an opportunity to react and refine the network. Thank you.
Linda Sheehan, followed by Vern Gehring, followed by Tom Raftikin, and then April Wakeman.
Good afternoon. Linda Sheehan, Executive Director for the California Coastkeeper Alliance. We represent 12 waterkeepers spanning the entire coast. I'll focus on lessons learned and touch on the socioeconomic analysis. I was a member of the statewide interest group and have been involved in many, many, many stakeholder processes over the years. And I would like to commend staff for the very sincere and extra effort that they put into making this process incredibly accessible through many venues, mail, website, meetings, et cetera, to the general public, both involved specifically in the process and outside of the process. So I thought it was an incredibly open process, as Ms. Garrison said earlier, and it was a success in that respect. The Central Coast area is fortunate in that it's relatively free from some of the water quality issues that were touched on earlier. Certainly there's issues, but some areas of the state that you'll be moving to over time certainly have more of those issues. And I think it's absolutely correct, as Mr. Hattai was saying earlier, that other agencies have numerous authorities and we should work closely with them because there are many opportunities to leverage those authorities to get more benefits out of the MLPA process as you're citing marine protected areas, but also as you're implementing chosen areas over time as well, both through the protections provided by those authorities, but also potential funding sources through Prop 84, OSPRS, OSPAF. There are ways to leverage that funding for clean water into additional benefits for habitat and marine protected areas. And one more thing is, of course, the department does have pollution authority through Fish and Game Code Section 5650 and has been doing some very good work on dairies and other areas in that regard. So, again, there's some additional authority in-house to be able to start to work on that. And I would be more than happy to work with you as the process moves forward in ways to leverage all of those opportunities to greater success and greater ecosystem-based management, as Chair Eisenberg said earlier. Briefly, on the socioeconomic analysis, again, over time, I've seen, as you have, I'm sure, the difficulty and the complexity of the process in integrating environmental costs and benefits. It's very easy to identify costs and benefits to existing industry, but environmental change takes time. Reprotected area benefits take time. We need to look at this socioeconomic data over time, take an expansive view of what's included, both in terms of timing and in terms of consumptive versus non-consumptive, and just in general environmental uses, and take a truly broad and comprehensive and appropriately comprehensive look at what socioeconomic benefits mean, so we get the best analysis and the most useful analysis for decision-making purposes. Thank you very much.
Vern Gehring, followed by Tom Raftikin, followed by April Wakeman, followed by Jim Martin.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, I'm Vern Gehring, representing the California Fisheries Coalition. We hear frequently that a Blue Ribbon Task Force is necessary in the process going forward because the Fish and Game Commission does not have the capacity to carry out the implementation of MLPA. Now, we certainly don't hear that in official reports, but that's what we hear frequently offline. We are amazed by that argument because we see you or individuals who seek your appointment to your position. You run the gauntlet of reviews by the governor, the Senate, and the public. You take an oath of office committing yourself to faithfully discharge your duties. You alone have the legal authority and responsibility to implement the MLPA and a whole host of fish and game laws. You hold office for 4 to 8 years, which means you have a need to pay attention to the long-term success and cost of your decisions, and you are subject to conditions that can lead to removal from office. While you don't have the capacity to carry out the law, a task force that is not subject to any of the requirements you are, who takes no oath, who withstands no Senate or public scrutiny to their appointment, who is here for 2 years and then gone, they, however, are capable of carrying out what is likely the most complex and controversial addition to the Fish and Game Code in many years. The same contradictory views apply to staff, public servant employees versus employees and consultants handpicked by a private funder. The first MOU to carry out the initiative or the MLPA is interesting. It lays out a strict timeline for completing specific products or deliverables and says that as long as adequate progress is made, the funder will continue to provide funds. It says that the private funder will retain staff and consultants to help the task force, and that these hires will be done upon recommendation of the task force, not upon recommendation of the public agencies legally responsible under the law, a typical carrot and stick held by the funders, we think. Now, I know that the BRTF members were all highly qualified, talented people, and I knew many of them and know many of them and respect them, and that the staff and the consultants were likely also. But the process used for the first phase of the MLPA is ripe for abuse and should be abandoned. I doubt those who say you are not capable realize the implications with regards to the quality of the governor's appointments. I think that if you and the department were given $3 million annually to designate MPAs like the BRTF was, you too could be found capable. We recommend that there be no surrogate commission in the form of a BRTF, that public servant employees be allowed to do what the law requires of them, that private contributions be appropriated to the commission and the department with legislative oversight, that a proper amount of time be devoted to implementing MLPA so that it is more than simply another layer of fishing restrictions. We should not try to make up for the lost time of a previous administration. And private funders should not develop the policy structure of a regulatory program. I often wonder if and when the LNG industry, the oil companies, and the Building Industry Association will ever discover this cool model for getting approval of their projects. I'm sure there are many who hope they don't. Thank you very much for your time.
Tom Raftikin, followed by April Wakeman, followed by Jim Martin, followed by Bob Fletcher.
Mr. President, members of the Commission, Tom Raftigan, United Anglers of Southern California. Lessons learned offer a great jumping off place, and how do we get into the next region, and how do you actually start moving forward? I've got a couple of suggestions. In the first iteration, there was considerable questions about science, and I think you remember at the last meeting, I think in August, where you had the CFC came forward and set out a different science agenda than the SAT had. If you go back a year and a half, United Anglers of Southern California proposed putting forward a workshop where you start balancing the science. You bring in both sides of this stuff. You take a look at it. And this really seems to make an awful lot of sense. We had questions down the line. A lot of the scientists can't stay engaged for an entire one-and-a-half-year process. But if you start laying out scientific guidelines at the beginning, you can balance the scientific fisheries managers along with the environmental ecologist who carried the day. One other area that I think is very important is there was extensive public involvement in the process, and the BRTF, as you noted, was key to getting a plan on the ground. I mean, if it wasn't for them, it wouldn't be here. The commission was removed from the process to a large extent. It wasn't intimately involved with it, and no one debates the fact that you folks don't have enough staff. I mean, that's really key to the thing of staying involved, is having staff be able to do this. We'd like to make another proposal. We've done this before, actually, but the MLPA has just hired additional staff. I mean, you've seen millions of dollars going out, and the department's hiring the staff, and they've got 11 new positions, and the commission desperately needs staff. It would be easy to modify the MOU to have that staff report directly to the commission. If that staff reports to the commission, then you have a direct link with the BRTF. I think Vern made some interesting comments and interesting arguments before. A lot of them are valid. But if this staff reports to you, it does two things. One, it gets you the staff necessary that you richly deserve. And number two, it shortens the process and puts the policy decisions exactly where they belong, in your hands, not in the Department of Fish and Game. So just a couple of suggestions on how you move forward in the next region. And thank you.
April Wakeman, followed by Jim Martin, followed by Bob Fletcher, followed by Zeke Grader.
Good morning. My name is April Wakeman. I work for United Anglers of Southern California. And I'm standing up to support Cindy Gustafson's suggestion regarding restriction of the regional stakeholder group. It's easy to say we should restrict the number. Of course, how you restrict it affects all of us. The division has always been between consumptive and non-consumptive, and I realize that's part of the act itself. In my mind, I've always considered it between those people having actual contact with the water and the marine environment versus those not having any contact. Fishing may have less contact with the ecosystem than scuba divers. It's how you look at it. Fishermen have often been lumped together in this process, and recreational fishermen definitely have different use, a different impact, and different interests with regards to the MPA. We are vitally concerned with conservation and want to make sure that the fish are out there. We're very, very inefficient when it comes to catching fish. In fact, I go one step beyond catch and release. I don't even catch them. They're just out there. Lord knows that we'd starve if I was putting fish on the table, but to group commercials and recreationals together really isn't fair. Recreational fishermen pay we support the department. I think the last number I heard was about $55 million a year. We'd like to see both the commercials and the environmental groups put in that much money to support the department's activities, because it's important. So, in any case, we'd like to suggest that, as Cindy was talking about, if the regional stakeholder starts large, and maybe we can winnow it down, but it's important that we don't alienate one group or make anyone feel left out. Thank you.
Jim Martin, followed by Bob Fletcher, followed by Zeke Grader, followed by Steve Scheiblauer.
Jim Martin, Recreational Fishing Alliance. I wanted to speak to something I heard the department say, that they were not going to be recommending a preferred alternative. And a lot of times it's useful to, when you go to these meetings, to pull up the law, the operating law, the MLPA Act. In section 2856 says that the department and team, that means the master plan team, and I'm going to come back to that later, shall develop a preferred siting alternative that incorporates information and views provided by people who live in the area. And I think that is really important because the Fish and Game the Department of Fish and Game understands how to promulgate regulations, how it's going to be enforced, are these rules enforceable? And I don't think it's appropriate to be discussing a Blue Ribbon Task Force that is going to come up with this. Earlier in the Act, it also called, I talked about the master plan team. The master plan shall be prepared with the advice, assistance, involvement of participants in the various fisheries and their representatives, marine conservationists, scientists, and other interested persons. In preparing the master plan, the department shall confer to the extent feasible with the Commission, the Pacific Fishery Management Council, the National Marines Fisheries Service. I'm going to stop there and ask the department, did that happen?
Yes. Early on it did, and those representatives withdrew, but they didn't have time.
But has it gone to the council? Has this ever been on the agenda of the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, the master plan? As required by law. I talked to Mark Helvey of the NOAA, and he's very concerned about this. In the last meeting, I mentioned canary rockfish, and we're right up against our 44 metric ton allowable catch. If we go over that, all ground fisheries on the West Coast shut down. And we don't. And I made the point that by closing longshore hard bottom, you're pushing people out into canary country. So I'd like the department at some point to bring this to the council and have an open discussion about it. Thank you very much.
Bob Fletcher, followed by Zeke Grader, followed by Steve Scheiblauer, followed by Michael Sutton.
Good afternoon, President Flores and members of the council and commission and members of the staff. I am Bob Fletcher, president of the Sport Fishing Association of California, and for 15 years I was a voting member of the Pacific Fishery Management Council. Several months ago I was approached by a fisherman's cooperative from Natividad Island. That's a small island off the coast of Central Baja in the Pacific. They came to me because they had worked with an environmental NGO group and developed a network of marine protected areas around Natividad Island. And they wanted to make sure that my boats that operated in those general waters would know where those were located and understand how important it was that we avoid them. I bring this up because the fishermen working with this group and with representatives of the Mexican government came together to develop this network. The fishermen supported the idea. They supported the adoption of these closed areas. And they are today the most vocal supporters of them. They help monitor the closed areas, and they help enforce the areas from poachers. I bring this to you as a way of giving you a lesson learned, and I hope that the commission will recognize just what a win-win that was and how important it is that whenever possible the MLPAI process recognizes the importance of that approach. I heard on several occasions the value of developing an ecosystem-based approach to management. I heard Commissioner Hathaway talk about taking a holistic approach. I heard Sonke Mastrup, Deputy Director of the Department, talk about partnering with sister agencies. I support Jim Martin's comments about working with the Pacific Fishery Management Council in recognition of the job they do that has an impact on the species that the fishermen are after. All of this is part of that holistic approach, and that has to be a lesson learned going forward. Thank you very much.
Zeke Grader, followed by Steve Scheiblauer, followed by Michael Sutton, followed by Caitlin Gaffney.
Thank you, Mr. President and staff. My name is Zeke Grader, and I'm the Executive Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. I think my comments here to you today basically are the lessons that haven't been learned. Although I would say that I think the comments from President Flores and Commissioner Hattoy gave me hope, because I think at least one of the lessons I was worried about that was, went unlearned is at least been learned by the Commission. And that is specifically that we have to look at all the factors affecting our marine life, not just fishing itself. Now, my organization supported the MLPA, much to the chagrin of some of my our fellow members in the commercial fishing industry and recreational fishing industry in 1999, because specifically, one, we wanted to make sure that if reserves were going to be created off the coast, that they would be scientifically based, that there would be some process for them, not simply a wealthy Malibu resident who saw a dolphin as a citizen, but not their gardener or the woman working in their kitchen as a citizen, you know, trying to make these reserves, making a, you know, a clear view shed so they didn't have to look at any dirty fishing boats. We wanted to see some science in this, and we thought for that reason the MLPA, as it euphemistically is called, these no fishing zones would be useful. Furthermore, we actually do see some value in establishing these reserves and have worked for them in the past, specifically off Bodega and that. But we see them as having a very limited value. And this, I think, is what is so troublesome to us in this whole process, is that we had never anticipated that there was going to be so much emphasis put on by the commission, the department, so much time taken by NGOs and scientists in a process that we thought would probably be go slow, establish these things where they're needed, and put them in their proper perspective. Because keep in mind what these really are about. These are not marine protected areas. These are circles on charts where you're saying there's no fishing. Because quite clearly we're not affecting the other factors. And that, I think, is clear in the most recent report that came from Science magazine that talked about the demise of our fisheries by 2048 unless some things were done. And I think people ought to read that carefully beyond just the headline, because it identified clearly that we have to address pollution. We're going to have to address invasives. It's not just fishing. We have to address the whole gamut of things. And from that standpoint, I commend some of those who have been talking about, let's start getting on the pollution issues. Moreover, we have to look much broader than simply these little specks on charts, these circles we put on charts and say, thou shalt not fish. We have to really look at the whole ocean if we're going to do a job of protecting it, and we have to look at all the factors. Now, that gets me to the second lesson, which I would say is the lesson I think on learned so far, and that is all the attention that has been put on this whole issue. What we really need a blue ribbon task force in this state is one to address fish and game's funding or lack thereof. We need a blue ribbon task force on our warden problem. We have about half the warden force we have, and we're not attracting the best people because we're not offering the best benefits. We need a blue ribbon task force looking at the range of scientific research in the marine area and the dearth of information and our ability to keep that together. We need a blue ribbon task force looking at ecosystem management and just exactly what it entails. So I guess my take-home lesson to all of you, and I hope it'd be the lesson learned, is that in the priority of things, these no-fishing zones that we're creating and all the hoopla is about are fine, but in the priority of things, in the priority of conserving our marine fish and the priority of conserving our ocean waters, they're probably down about number 9 or maybe number 17. And I think in all this process, let's start getting our priorities in order and having the Blue Ribbon Task Force start attacking the big issues, not something that really is a fly speck as far as marine conservation goes. Thank you.
Steve Scheiblauer, followed by Michael Sutton, followed by Caitlin Gaffney, followed by Paul Weakland.
I'm Steve Scheiblauer. I'm the harbor master for the city of Monterey. I'm also speaking to you as a stakeholder, and was part of this process from the very beginning. I concur that I do not believe that there should be an additional or a new Blue Ribbon Task Force. I think the commission needs to be directly involved. I would suggest a more specific thing that's been heard before, which is this be done by a single table workshop concept. Put the scientists and the stakeholders and some other representatives together in the same room, same table, direct dialogue, a series of 2 and 3 day meetings over time, guidance by Fish and Game staff, and with the ability to actually model their products, both in socioeconomics and also the biological models. And I think you'd get a far superior product in a far more efficient way if you would do that. A little concerned about Mr. Kerlin's remark about the middle ground, having stakeholders, a bigger group of middle ground stakeholders. That really sounds good, but aren't stakeholders by definition having an interest or having a particular point of view? And so you have to make sure that you capture that. And I don't really see how you can have a large body of people with no opinions on a stakeholder group. Regarding Mr. Hardy's report, I think he did a very good job in summarizing the essential issues and questions before you. I'm a community person. I'm representing the city of Monterey here in these remarks that we have always been concerned about the impacts on our community for the MPA plans as they come forward. We are proud of our heritage and culture of fishing and the economic contributions. We're also very aware of how it plays in our tourism economy. People come to Monterey for these reasons, to eat fresh fish and what have you. And a thorough socioeconomic evaluation really needs to get at those questions. We also would value a really good study of non-consumptive benefits. And I will caution that that's a very complex question, because people can't see the benefits of MPAs by and large. It's not like a great white shark in the aquarium. And secondly, and probably more importantly, there is so much current exploitation of the natural resources by the tourism industry in coastal communities by and large. Every hotel, every chamber of commerce has pictures of birds and sea otters and whales and what have you. The real question would be, what more does this do to bring people that's not already being fully exploited? But if a study could get at those kinds of questions, we would value it. During this process, I want to point out, and Mr. Hardy spoke to this a little bit, that there was never a discussion about when the MLPA was met or exceeded. That discussion never came out of the SATs or the Blue Ribbon Task Force or what have you. So you were led to never really know whether you were trying to have a balanced system or, as he pointed out, a system or rather recommendation that maximized views. That was just a wide open thing. That discussion needs to happen. Thank you very much. And I have a written my presentation.
Michael Sutton, I guess Amy is going to speak for him.
With your
followed
permission.
Followed by Caitlin Gaffney, followed by Paul Weakland.
Okay. Thank you very much. My name is Amy David. I am a policy analyst at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. I'm here speaking on behalf of Mike Sutton, Vice President of the Aquarium and Director of the Center for the Future of the Oceans, who just had to step out. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today. I think taking the time to focus on lessons learned in the MLPA initiative process thus far is very wise, considering the overwhelming amount of time and effort that you and your staff have given, as well as the time and effort of all of the other tireless participants in this process. Every element of the process that we've just been through has proved to be critical. The regional stakeholder group included a wide representation of vital interests. The science advisory team provided the best possible scientific advice, and the Blue Ribbon Task Force elevated the debate and provided you with independent analysis and expert review. We recommend that this process be continued as we all strive to fulfill the purpose of the Marine Life Protection Act to create a network of protection throughout the coastline. I also caution against focusing too heavily on short-term impacts instead of working to maximize long-term benefits associated with enhanced protection and restoration. As Mike reminded me before he had to leave, this limited viewpoint has led to numerous failures in our fishery management system. He also reminded me of another cautionary tale from fishery management. Prior to 1996, the Magnuson Act allowed catch levels to be increased based on socioeconomic concerns. After the Sustainable Fisheries Act was passed, catch levels were only allowed to be decreased based on these concerns. This change was made because it was recognized that an overemphasis on socioeconomic concerns often was not in the best interest of sustaining the resource. The Marine Life Protection Act is a protection statute, and the process we have now is an effective one for achieving this goal while minimizing socioeconomic harm. Thank you very much.
Caitlin Gaffney, followed by Paul Weakland.
Good morning. Caitlin Gaffney with the Ocean Conservancy. I served on the regional stakeholder group, and so I'm bringing that perspective to you today. I did offer comments on a lessons learned exercise for the Blue Ribbon Task Force a few weeks ago. It's my understanding that you were provided the written product from that, so I'm not going to go into too much detail on that issue. But just wanted to say that I thought that many of the comments made earlier by Mr. Curlin and Mr. Mastrop offered useful suggestions on how to move forward and improve. I think that many of the challenges we faced on the Central Coast were really just inherent to being the first phase, sort of growing pains, and that the issues such as timeliness of access to information and clarity on roles will make a big difference in our relatively easy fixes. I do think that as we move forward, the focus should be on anything that encourages stakeholders to seek common ground. Not consensus, that's not possible, but common ground. So the more we can focus on that, the better. That said, I also think it's inevitable that at the end of the day, there will always be complaints, that it is human nature to focus on the areas of disagreement that remain and not to emphasize all of the concessions and all the areas where we did come together. And I think this process is a good example of that. On the Hardy report, I think the report did a good job of identifying the extensive information that was available on socioeconomics and that was used throughout the process. My impression is that the biophysical side of the Marine Life Protection Act was fairly easy for the regional stakeholder group members to get a handle on. I know in the case of Package 2, the package I worked on, that took weeks. We had a draft of something that met the science requirements in October. It was 5 months and four iterations and versions to really try to get a better handle on the socioeconomics. And that's really where we spent most of our time, was trying to figure out how to maintain that fidelity to the law and to the science and be sensitive and respectful of socioeconomic concerns. I think we had a pretty good base of data to do that. We used common sense rules of thumb, such as avoiding areas close to port, spreading impacts as equitably as possible, looking at the flexibility of the fleet. Folks who had more opportunity to move around and shift their effort, those would be the folks that perhaps we would impact over folks who had less flexibility. So I think there's some pretty common sense rules that can be used. And we did use them, and I would recommend that that be the focus as we move forward. In terms of specifics, I do think that this issue of parity, making sure we have good both commercial and recreational, both consumptive and non-consumptive, both short-term and long-term data is really the way to go. And also focusing very specifically on spatially explicit information that will help us with MPA design, siting, evaluation, and ultimately a decision by the commission, as opposed to simply gathering as much information as possible. Thank you.
Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. As the speakers presented today, the first and foremost thing was to fulfill your duties. That assumptions have not been demonstrated, our lessons learned. We have been taught many lessons, but we have not been able to learn because of the cancellation or concealing of information. We have learned that there are no identified or detectable benefits in the Channel Island reserves. We also know that California has the oldest and largest marine protected areas of anywhere in the world. We learned that abalone closed from San Francisco south and all the islands of California have created no detectable benefits in their reconstruction or recovery. There is no satisfied scientific criteria. There is a lack of complexity. This is what the speaker said. That BRTF says more study is needed. Oh, of course. And we need to begin to modify and clarify a broader understanding. More extensive preparatory work is necessary. That's the homework that hasn't been done. It is a disappointment on alternative packages. We need to avoid the slowness of the process. There is a lack of ample opportunity for public comment. More openness and more visibility or transparency is needed. You are choosing not to recognize certain aspects of consideration or some effects. There are gaps of objective data. Again, we have the oldest and largest marine protected areas of anywhere in the world, but we have no peer review or accounting of these. What about the no project alternative? That is not being presented. Now, today in the news, it talks about the GPS failures around the world due to solar arrays. Now, this should be a lesson learned. Your GPS is failing today. All GPS around the world do not work at this moment. That is talking about the lack of enforcement of the MPAs. The MLPA says that all regulations have to be written in plain, simple language, easily understood by a person of average intelligence, and easily enforced. This is not happening. There is no fence line out there to hang a no fishing sign on. We've heard this from the game wardens over and over. Interpretation of the statute. What other interpretations are there? What other approaches are there? A lack of understanding and no benchmarks exist. This is reverse modeling. Social economics. The speakers say that there are elements that are not being considered, that it is not consistent and limited in its approach and scope. What are the payoffs? These are still being questioned. Availability of information is not correlated or collated in a systematic manner and may not be complete. It is problematic. The evaluation and analysis is flawed due to timeliness. There is a lack of clarity, and a level of value is still in question. It is not accurate, no possible or practical way to judge or gauge the effects. It is unduly narrow, not balanced, not equitable, or fair. Creating these dead zones do not benefit anyone but the grant-sucking parasites that are looking for more jobs and approaches and opportunities for study. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weakland. Mr. Mastrup, did you want to close?
Yes, Commissioners. The Department would like to bring up the issue that to incorporate the changes that we're proposing in the process for the next study area will require modification of the master plan, so we will be planning on bringing you back a new draft version to consider amending formally at the February meeting or at the following meeting in March.
Okay.
If the Commission, also just as a point of clarification, if the Commission chooses to entertain some of the recommendations from the lessons learned in terms of policies or guidelines, we would recommend the appropriate venue would be in the master plan, incorporating those things in the master plan. And if you so choose, we can be prepared to discuss that at the February meeting, which we would then, of course, need you to vote on at perhaps March, just as so you're
plan
aware.
To do so. Okay. Commissioners, questions?
What's that? I have no questions right now. I'm just wanting to comment, and I think what Mr. Mastrup just said is the best way to go. If there's going to be any kind of changes or fine-tuning, it should be done through the master plan framework. And I need to digest all of this. I need to digest the comments and the suggestions of the Hardy Report. I'm pretty sure that I wanted to state that I'm comfortable with the way things are going. There's some small changes that could be made regarding making sure people are more comfortable with involvement at the stakeholder level and the socioeconomic data issues. I personally believe are only helpful to us if they help us make a decision based on spatial data and a body of knowledge based on helping us choose maybe a boundary or and making sure that recreational and commercial folks are considered equally and that we look at spreading the pleasure or the pain depending on what our decision is. But I'm okay with all of this because I think we have to talk about, one second, I'm going to, the big change that's taking place both in this commission and what we're being asked to do by the legislature and by all the folks that are involved. For over a century, this commission has dealt with the issues of hunting and fishing in the traditional sense of the hook and bullet regulations. And now, with the MLPA and the MA, we are, in effect, the Ocean Commission in dealing with our legislative authority on how we can impact the oceans. Of course, we all talked earlier about the holistic approach. I think bringing in other agencies through the Ocean Protection Council or through the Resources Secretary to have a sort of think tank approach to how we do these things for the future is good. But what we have before us is the MLPA, and it clearly states that socioeconomics is only one factor to consider. We have the legal analysis that I think we all knew of already, but this commission doesn't even have to go nearly as far as what we've done, but we did it because we care. We care about every single individual that this law and our actions impact. It's clear from the law that the biophysical considerations and the ecosystem-based goals are the keys to this law. This law draws out six goals and requirements, and socioeconomics is not one of them, but there's not anyone in this room that would want to ignore that. So we want to give that a proper looking at, if you will, but in no way does it have any legal status from an equal standpoint, other than how it pulls on our hearts, if you will. And you've seen us struggle with these things. You've seen the stakeholder groups, as Ms. Gaffney discussed, 5 months for one of the programs looking at socioeconomics. I know the BRTF has done that. So I think any way that we can make the socioeconomic analysis help people understand why we're doing what we're doing and why we're drawing the lines on the map can also help us make a bigger decision. But we don't need socioeconomic data out to the most extreme degree. It's no help to me to figure out what a fisherman on a boat makes for a salary and therefore what his company makes and therefore what the, you know, that industry makes and therefore every fish is worth $2,500,000 or in the reverse, a family going to the Big Sur Headlands and staying at the Ventana Inn for $2,000 a night, and therefore he makes $1 million salary. I mean, it's ludicrous to me to bring it to those extremes. We have to keep it spatially oriented, and we have to keep it through the directions of the law in which we're operating in. One more comment about lessons learned and the feelings of some people that the BRTF or the scientific advisory team or the regional groups are somehow taking away our authority. I completely and totally disagree. They are teams of people that the department, the secretary, and the director has appointed or asked to serve to help this commission make our decisions. I'll be the first to admit I don't know everything. And stakeholders bring me information. The scientific advisory team has helped me, and so has the BRTF. It would be like saying we should get rid of the Altauscher Committee or the Herring Advisory Board or any other advisory board we have. And that would be ludicrous also because those people bring invaluable information to this commission. So I think the BRTF process, the stakeholder process, the scientific advisory process, and adding what we've discussed with more commission involvement and more department involvement from the beginning to the end is the way to go. I see no reason to make any substantial changes, and I know that Commissioner Rogers may have a different opinion. I want to acknowledge that he is really concerned about this, and he's, you know, unable to be here today, so I'd hate to do anything without his input out of respect for his concerns. But there I am. I'm okay with things. I think we did a good job, and some fine-tuning is necessary, but I'm ready to move on with this model, despite the groans and moans I'm hearing from some of the people in the room. And that's how I feel about it.
Thank you. Commissioner?
Thank you. I had a couple responses to some of the public comment we heard. I understand the concerns and listened carefully to your concerns about the Blue Ribbon Task Force and their role. I've got to say that I think this commission takes very seriously our role, that we did not abdicate in any way to the Blue Ribbon Task Force, but we did take very seriously the work that was done through that process. So whether they took an oath of office or not was not important to me. It was what was the process used and what were the outcomes. And then it came to us, and we very seriously spent a lot of time deliberating the various issues there. But I do take your concerns seriously, and I think we as a commission must be much more involved with the Blue Ribbon Task Force this go-around in the next study areas. And I think we're taking steps with our own staff and with ourselves to be more involved. Specifically, I would like to suggest that we look at a joint meeting. I think the recommendation of C3, a joint meeting to talk a little more about the socioeconomics, is very valuable, since that is going to be the area where we are going to, no matter what we do, have controversy and impacts. This is the real nuts of the issue. I guess nuts and bolts of the whole issue is protecting areas that do impact people's lives economically. So I'd like to for us to consider that, and we can wait till we have a full commission to talk about when and how that might happen and whether there's a reappointment of a Blue Ribbon Task Force. Secondly, I also agree with my fellow commissioners who went on record earlier today saying we need to be concerned about the other impacts to the marine environment. You know, annually we have a joint meeting with the Forestry Board, and I think it would be much, I don't want to put down that meeting, but it would be much more valuable at this point in time to look at a joint meeting with several of the boards that would be involved on oceans, influencing ocean environments. I think personally that would be a much higher priority at this point on our agendas and the issues we're facing, to hold that joint meeting, have the staffs of the various agencies report on what they are doing to try to protect the ocean environment, and for us as joint boards to make some recommendations that may end up at the legislature, the governor's office, whatever, for changes there, because I do think that we need to take the lead on that. That's a role where the commission can take a lead on setting up a joint meeting to do that. And I think those are all my notes now. Thank you.
Well, pretty much everybody knows my position on this. I think what's come out of this that I'd like to see go forward and that you all have addressed is a very good idea about bringing us together with our sister agencies so we can figure out collectively what approaches we're taking and how we might best go forward and, come up either with legislation or some stronger policies to impact even more what we're trying to accomplish here. The other thing is I really like to see this commission take a much more active role with either the BRTF or whoever comes forward in the future. And I think that will not that we will be a watchdog, but I think that maybe issues that come to us at the very end of the process will come to us maybe much earlier in the process, and we can sort of step in and help either mediate that or remedy some of those issues beforehand so they don't fester into a much bigger issue, so that people... You know, there's a balanced approach. I'm not saying that there wasn't this last time around. I've heard all sorts of comments. But I think that with our role, us playing a much bigger role in the next go around, I think we can alleviate some of those concerns. And as those issues arise, we can tackle them in a much more proactive approach as instead of at a reactive approach where we're, you know, nine-tenths down the road and the train has left the station, and it'd be much more difficult to do that. So I'd like to see that as we go forward.
And the only caveat, just the thought that I have after both of you. The only caveat I would add, having brought up the concept of the holistic approach, is that I wouldn't want us to not do our job. I mean, of course, the problem needs to be solved. And we can't be arrogant enough to think we're going to tell the PUC to stop using coal plants because the mercury is killing the fish. I want to meet with them and let you folks explain to them that's the issue.
I don't think, what I'm trying to say is
we have to do our job, and our job is like marine reserves.
It's like I said earlier, Bob, I mean, we have this rare opportunity where we have the light is on us.
Sure,
I mean,
and let's do our looking, job. And, the light is on
and
us.
And we've got the greatest bully pulpit one could ask for, and let's shed some light on it, and let's say, hey, we have certain piece of the of this puzzle here, and there's a lot of other pieces. And while I don't want to walk away and say we're not going to do ours just because they are not going to do theirs, we'll do ours. But we need to say to those folks, hey,
we're in agreement.
You've got a role in this, and if we're going to make this work, it has to be comprehensive. It's just not piecemeal here, and then, well, we hope somewhere down the road that that's going to take place. We ought to use whatever authority, whatever power, whatever influence we have, along with our constituents that are sitting out here in the audience today, and move forward and say, look, let's really tackle this. Let's really do something that's going to benefit the resources that we're trying to protect here. Okay? Commissioners, thank you for taking time from your busy schedules. I'd like to thank the public for their testimony. Mr. Kerlin, the Blue Ribbon Task Force, again, thank you very much. And we look forward to digesting this information and moving forward. And Mr. Hardy as well, thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.